Ecclesiastes 6, verse 10. What has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell what man will be after him under the sun? A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider God has made one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Now the preacher is going to tell us a few things that he's learned from this wisdom that he's just told us about. In my vain life, I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in evildoing. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out of them both. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man, more than 10 rulers to a city. But surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Don't take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. And your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been far off and deep, very deep, who can find it out? I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom in the scheme of things and to know wickedness and folly and foolishness that is madness. And I find something more bitter than death. The woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find a scheme of things which my soul has sought repeatedly but have not found. One man among 1,000 I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Once a woman named Lauren wrote a letter to an anger management therapist in search of some wisdom. She was a young mom who worked very hard at being a mother. She took care of her 2-year-old son and took care of the home while her husband was away. And she was great at it. She did everything all the mommy blogs tell you to do. She had an organic dinner on the table by 6 o'clock every night. She didn't clean her house with chemicals. She read all the child psychology books so she could take care of her son's mental and emotional needs. According to the world's definition of a good mom, she got top marks. But she wrote to this therapist because though she tried so hard to be good, she just couldn't do it. She could never hit the mark. She said she was a jealous person and that criticism, especially criticism about her parenting style, crushed her. In response to that criticism, she was often judgmental right back at people.
And because of all the stress she was under, she would regularly explode in fits of rage and anger at her husband and her child. Lauren felt terrible about all of these things. All she wanted, she said, was to be a good person. If she could just be good, she thought, her life would have some completeness to it. There would be a sense of fulfillment and happiness. But no matter how hard she tried, she just couldn't stop being angry and judgmental. At the end of the letter, she confessed to the therapist that she was ready to give up entirely on the quest to be good. These are her words. "I hate myself so much when I'm like this, and I feel like everyone would be better off if I wasn't around." So in what seemed like a last-ditch effort to be a good person and happy and content, Lauren asked the anger management therapist for some wisdom on how to do it. Lauren's letter reminds us of one of the fundamental desires that humans share. No matter where a person is from, no matter what culture they belong to, no matter what their background might be, no matter what period of time they live in, somewhere within each of us is a desire for moral purity. We humans, though we are flawed, though we are sinners, though we have desires that are contrary to God's word, want to be, usually, good people. Sadly, there's a misconception, especially in American evangelicalism, that a person can't be morally good without God. That's why a lot of Christian movies will paint a picture of the angry atheist who just revels in all kinds of immorality. But that's simply not the case. As Tim Keller has said, anyone who believes that non-Christians are by default less moral will run up against common sense and experience. I can guarantee you, if you go over to Penn State's campus and interact with purely secular professors and students, you will find a strong commitment to the pursuit of virtue. I'm sure that many of you have non-Christian neighbors and friends who, from the world's perspective, are pretty good people. They don't cheat on their spouses or their taxes. They try to live a moral life. They seek to instill a sense of morality in their children. They're kind and generous. People can be, to an extent, morally good without God. People do, after all, possess a God-given moral conscience that directs them in right and wrong. Humans like Lauren, like secular professors, and like you and me, want to be good. And just as importantly, humans believe that being a good person is a significant factor in finding a level of contentment and happiness in life. Most of you probably know Bruce Lee from his martial arts movies, but he was also a bit of a philosopher. He once said, "The measure of the moral worth of a man is his happiness. The better the man, the more happiness. Happiness is a symptom of well-being." And most people intuitively believe that if they can be good, their lives will turn out better. Perhaps not in material wealth or in freedom from suffering, but at least in some kind of inner peace. And therefore, because of our natural inclination to be good, hoping for levels of greater contentment and meaning to life, we humans are always on the lookout for some kind of wisdom on how to be better. Lauren reached out to an anger management therapist. Others tune in to the Dr. Phils and Oprahs of the world in hopes that they can find a little bit of information about how to be better. We believe that somewhere out in the world there is a teacher or a system of thought that will teach us the secret to being good. Lauren's letter reminds us of the fundamental desire of human beings to be good, and by being good to be happy. And it also reminds us of the universal human failure to achieve it. We want to be good people. We want to search and find the secret to being good, but Time and again, those fits of anger return. The moral failures we want so hard, so badly to overcome return. Or if we do end up overcoming them, something else in our life pops up. The therapists, the self-help books, and the seminars don't have the answers that we're looking for. Our efforts at being good are futile. You know what this is like. You really want your kids to be good people. You've tried every parenting technique, every kind of discipline, but there's not much change. You yourself want so badly to be better. You've gotten advice from everywhere. You've tried and tried and tried to be a good person, but you're still anxious. You still blow up at your spouse. You still lust. You're still grumpy. Maybe you're even grumpier now than you were 10 years ago. No matter what you've tried, you just can't do it. So while there is this deep desire to be good, there is at the same time the contentment-stealing, joy-thieving knowledge that this is impossible. This is the condition in which we find the preacher here in Ecclesiastes 7. For several weeks now, we have been following the preacher on his journey to find meaning and happiness. He already mentioned once, back in chapter 2, how he tried this. He tried to be a good, moral person. But he said there that it was meaningless. No matter how hard he tried, he couldn't find the secret to being good. Well, here in chapter 7, the preacher digs into this topic of goodness in detail. And what he wants to do is teach us something about the relationship between human wisdom and righteousness. After searching through all the systems of thought and the advice that the world has to offer on being a good person, the preacher has concluded that worldly wisdom cannot make you good. The preacher wants us to see that the world doesn't have any kind of wisdom that can quench the desire to be a good person. It doesn't have any ability to produce righteousness in us. In the passage, the preacher highlights four reasons why human wisdom is such a futile prospect, and therefore why worldly wisdom can't produce either goodness or joy or contentment in life. And ultimately, we'll see that the preacher wants to point us to the true secret of being good. Consider first, then, that as the preacher studied wisdom the world had to offer, he discovered that worldly wisdom could not provide a standard for righteousness. In 1965, the Rolling Stones sang, "I'm free to do what I want, any old time." The preacher doesn't put quite as positive a spin on it, but he communicates the same idea at several points through this passage. What he's showing us is if our only source of good is the wisdom of the world, it's impossible to determine a universal standard of morality which ultimately leaves people to do whatever they want. People are free to say that anything is good. The preacher has searched everywhere for wisdom about morality. He emphasized to us that he left no stone unturned in his search. But after all that searching, he says to us in chapter 6, verse 12, "Who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life?" The preacher wants to do good, to be good. But after searching and searching and searching, he has no ability to determine what good really is. Oh, he has some ideas about what it means to be good. That's the purpose of the long list of proverbs there at the beginning of chapter 7. It's important to note that none of the proverbs in verses 1 to 14 are found elsewhere in the Bible. What the preacher seems to be doing here is giving us a snapshot of the wisdom that he has collected. And what you'll notice as you study these Proverbs is that there is some good and true wisdom here. A good name is better than a precious ointment. That is certainly true. It's something that would be affirmed by every culture and people of which I'm aware. Our reputation, our integrity are more valuable than expensive perfume. But on the other hand, while there are some true things in these Proverbs, you'll also find some morally ambiguous statements. You'll find some things that he says that could be true or false depending on how you look at it. For example, in verse 7, the preacher says, "It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all mankind, and the living lay at heart." Well, if what he means is that we have a lot to learn from suffering, perhaps we can learn more from suffering than we can from feasting, then that is true. But if he means that suffering is a moral good and feasting is a moral evil, then he's wrong. If he means that suffering is better than feasting just because it's suffering, then he is wrong. If he means that death is better than life, then he is wrong. This is the conundrum commentators have faced as they've tried to interpret this book over the years. What's the preacher trying to teach us? Is he being positive or negative? Is he meaning us to take these things as true or false? Well, I would say that's exactly the point. The wisdom the world has to offer can sometimes get us close to righteousness. But while it can tell us some things that are true, like the importance of a good reputation, it cannot get us all the way to a universal system of right and wrong. The world's wisdom always leaves us with moral ambiguity. This is well illustrated by the end of chapter 7. The preacher is discussing whether or not truly righteous people can be found in the world. We'll come back to that idea in a little bit. He says, "I found something that's more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters." What is important here is something that's a little bit unclear in our English translations. And it's that he isn't just talking about one woman. The pastor, the preacher, is lumping all women together. That's why he says he can't find one woman out of 1,000 who is righteous. Not a single woman. They're all snares and fetters. They're all temptresses who are trying to get men to sin sexually. The preacher is a misogynist. He's a sexist who believes that women are by default, because they are women, less moral than men. So isn't it interesting? In the preacher's search for wisdom, he's gleaned all this stuff in verses 1 to 14. But because he has no ultimate standard by which to judge right and wrong, he can't see the sin right in front of his face. So what we learn is that because worldly wisdom has no ultimate standard, while it can get some things right, worldly wisdom cannot speak authoritatively to the human conscience and say, "This is how you should live." As a result, people's definition of what is good can be anything they want it to be. That's why you can go speak to secular professors at Penn State and secular students at Penn State who have a moral conscience given to them by God and who love virtue, but who at the same time can believe passionately, vigorously, that gay marriage and gender reassignment, surgery and abortion and things like these are morally good, morally right, something to be pursued. This is why at the end of his search, wisdom seems so far off and hidden to the preacher. When you take God out of the equation, when there is no ultimate standard, people are without any kind of moral obligation. what is good can mean anything they want it to mean. If that's the case, how can we be truly good? Second, as the preacher studied the wisdom the world had to offer, he discovered that worldly wisdom cannot provide a compelling motivation for righteous living. One thing that stands out about the letter that Lauren wrote to her anger management therapist is her motivation for wanting to be good. At one point, she writes about how she's a nice person who does a lot of good things for people. However, she admits that she does these things because she craves love and attention from people. Then she sums up her letter by citing what is her primary motivation. She wanted to be a good person so that she could be truly happy and at peace with herself. Her righteousness was self-serving. But what the preacher would say to Lauren is that these are weak motivations that never have the power to produce real goodness. Rather, they only have the power to make us give up. That's what the preacher found. In verses 15 to 18, the preacher reveals his motivations for being good. He talks about how in his life he had seen a righteous man who perished in spite of his righteousness, and a wicked man who prospered. On account of this, he says in verse 16, "Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise." We can infer then that prior to his search for righteousness, the preacher believed that if he achieved a certain level of personal righteousness, he would prosper. That he would be rewarded in some way. That was his motivation. But as time went by, the preacher discovered that life doesn't work that way. The world does not reward us according to our goodness, our righteousness. And nor does God. God does not promise to return earthly blessings to us on account of our good deeds. The point of the verses then is that since being good is no guarantee of any kind of personal benefit, there's no need to be good. You see, when the preacher realized that his righteousness wasn't going to profit him more than being wicked, he found no reason to continue trying to be good. It's the same for us. If our primary motivation for right living is personal gain, we're going to have a really hard time being good. I want to harp on Lauren. I don't want to be too hard on her. But she didn't realize, and neither did her therapist, as we'll see later, that her motivations for righteousness were totally insufficient. She could be as good as possible. She still may never receive love or praise or attention from anybody. She could be the best mom on the face of the planet, and people still might criticize her parenting style. She might do everything right as a mom, and in the end, her kid may fly off the deep end when he gets out of the house. If happiness is the reward that we're looking for as the fruit of being good, we can never be happy. Lauren could never be happy because she's going to realize that she can't ever be good enough. She's never going to be able to hit a mark of goodness that will finally give her what she's looking for. Human wisdom can tell us to try really, really hard to be good, but it can't give us a reason to do it. In the end, human wisdom makes us give up on morality. You know, people in the church today are trying to figure out why so many kids leave the faith after high school. The numbers are astounding. A ridiculous amount of children leave Christianity after they go to college. Some people think it's the liberal professors. That probably happens sometimes, but I don't think it's the biggest reason. I think the main reason kids leave church is It's because so many kids grow up in homes and churches where they hear an anemic gospel that reduces Christianity to moral platitudes. Don't have sex outside of marriage. Don't smoke. Don't drink. Don't cuss. Don't support a gay marriage. And then they go off to college and they realize that their morality doesn't win them anything in the world. Actually, they realize that it's possible to be not overly wise and at the same time not be a total idiot and still make it in the world. Our kids need a better motivation for godliness, for obedience, for righteousness than don't have sex, don't get drunk. They need a better motivation for these things than you might get an STD. I wonder, what's your motivation for righteous living? Is it self-serving? Is it for your personal gain? Do you do good in order to be recognized, to be rewarded? It's no wonder you feel like giving up. Third, the preacher discovered that worldly wisdom could not provide an accurate model for righteous living. Don't know if any of you listen to ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast or not, but recently they produced a series of podcasts on Bikram Chowdhury, a professional yoga instructor. To many who followed Bikram's model from afar, Bikram was the patron saint of yoga. He seemed like the perfect guy who had it all together. But as time went by, it came out that Bikram was not all that his public image made him out to be. He had been using yoga for years as a way to manipulate, harass, and assault women who came to his classes. The story of Bikram is an extreme case of what the preacher teaches us in Ecclesiastes 7. No matter how good someone may appear, they're not as righteous as they seem. The preacher has been searching everywhere for how to be good. He's looked for someone who can show him the path of righteousness, the secret to true morality, but he cannot find him. In verses 25 to 29, he says that he's looked everywhere to find a righteous person. But he's only found one man out of 1,000 and no women. Again, he's being a sexist. I don't think we're to read this literally. I don't think he means that out of 1,000, he literally found one man who was righteous. I think he means simply that a truly virtuous and righteous person is really hard to find. The preacher's on to something here, isn't he? How can we learn righteousness from someone who is not himself or herself perfectly righteous? Partial righteousness won't cut it. Without a model of perfect righteousness, we cannot know with certainty what it means to live a virtuous life. No wonder the preacher is frustrated. No wonder he's ready to give up on righteousness. Who can be righteous? The preacher would say that even if those people who seem he would say that even those people who seem like they have it all together can't be relied upon to teach us righteousness, because even if it's in small ways, they're still flawed. They're not as accurate as they need to be to teach us true wisdom. This is one of the reasons Paul got on the Corinthians, isn't it? Some there in the church were saying, well, I follow Apollos and I follow Paul. But Paul said, when you say this, are you not being purely human? Paul and Apollos were great men, but in themselves they were nothing. It's the same with every hero. William Carey, one of the greatest Christian men who ever lived, the first missionary to India. Still today, you can go over there and see the school that he started to teach other missionaries. He's a hero. But He totally ignored the mental and emotional needs of his wife in order to get to India. Jonathan Edwards, probably the greatest, most renowned theologian who has ever come out of America and perhaps ever will. He was a slave owner. Our heroes don't hit the mark. That's why when we look to our heroes themselves as our guide, our model, we're always going to be disappointed. And if we're like the preacher, that disappointment in our flawed heroes wants to make us give up on holiness. That's why we only follow after people as they follow after Christ. But more on that in a minute. The preacher has told us much about the failure of human wisdom to make us good. But he has one more thing to teach us. It's that worldly wisdom could not provide an answer to personal unrighteousness. Lauren wanted to be good. She wanted to be a better mom and a better wife. She wanted to be less angry and less judgmental. But she had a problem and she knew it. Her failures in parenting were not her child's fault. Her judgmental spirit was not caused by her friends. Lauren's biggest problem in being good was Lauren. This is the admission of the preacher and all those who try to be good. The preacher has come to the end of his quest. He's looked everywhere, investigated every philosophy and system of thought, but he concludes, "All this I have tested by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been far off and deep, very deep, who can find it out?" Then in verse 29, "This alone I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." In that verse, the preacher calls the opening chapters of Genesis to mind. There we're told that God did create humans as morally good people without any lack whatsoever in personal righteousness. But since the fall of Adam and Eve into sin, we humans have sought out many schemes. The prophet Isaiah said that we have each gone our own way. And the apostle Paul told the church in Rome that no one is righteous, not even a single person. Indeed, as the preacher said, there is not a man on earth who does good and never sins. It's interesting that the one undeniable truth that human wisdom can get right is this. It's almost like God planned it that way. We know it intuitively. It's written on our hearts. Our consciences bear witness. We are not righteous. Just like Lauren, we miss the mark over and over again, no matter how hard we try. That's what sin is, falling short of the mark. But try as it might, worldly wisdom has no sufficient answer to our plight. The best human wisdom can do with our innate sense of unrighteousness is try and deny it. That was the evidence that Lauren's therapist gave. He told her that the most important thing she could do to be good was to spend time believing in her own goodness of heart and to connect, he said, with her good inner nature. But such advice can never work, at least not for long, because the more we try to be good, the more we try to connect with some inner sense of goodness, the more we're going to find that it's not there. Though we may want to be moral, though we may want to be righteous, our hearts are keenly aware of our failures. If we're honest with ourselves, the best that we can say is that wisdom and righteousness are far off from us. Sadly, though, while the wisdom the preacher found could show him his sins, it didn't help him to see the bigger problem. Sin doesn't just make us bad people. Sin makes us damned people. Our personal unrighteousness makes us worthy recipients of the holy wrath of a just God. So then, as the preacher might say, this is the end of the matter. Being good is futile. It's pointless. You can't do it. As one made in the image of God, you may possess a desire to be good, but you are unrighteous, and you have nothing good in yourself that can produce goodness. And what's worse, because of this unrighteousness, you deserve hell. What's the answer? The preacher thought it was wisdom, but he searched everywhere and he could not find the secret. But beloved, what the preacher did not realize is that the wisdom he was looking for was not a philosophy. It was not a system of thought. It was not good advice. It was a person. At the end of the search, the preacher concluded that wisdom about how to be good was hidden from him. But what he didn't realize was, as the Puritan Matthew Henry said, that this wisdom has not been hidden from us, but for us in the person of Jesus Christ. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 24, that Jesus is in himself the wisdom of God. Brothers and sisters, it is Jesus who reveals to us how to be good. In Jesus, we have one who set the standard of righteousness. It was the Spirit of Christ who sent both the apostles and the prophets before them to give us one universally binding standard of morality, the holy law of God. It is Jesus who provides the motivation for right living, which is not that in being good we might be happy, but that in being good we might give glory to God. It is Jesus who, as the perfectly righteous man, is our model for righteousness, and who promises that if we come to him and take his yoke on us, that he will teach us what it means to be righteous. And most importantly, it is Jesus, as the wisdom of God, who provides the answer to our personal unrighteousness. The preacher believed that the way to compensate for his lack of righteousness was to achieve righteousness himself. But the wisdom of Christ says that righteousness is not an achievement, but a gift. The way Jesus covers our personal unrighteousness is by giving us his own. It's what he did on the cross. On the cross, Jesus took on all of our personal unrighteousness and gave us his righteousness. Here's the thing about being a Christian. When you come to Christ by faith, you don't merely receive the forgiveness of sins, as great as it is. You don't simply get a clean slate. When you come to Christ, you are given all the goodness you could ever need. When you come to Christ, though you are a sinner, though you will still miss the mark, though you will still be a fool from time to time, in the eyes of God, you are counted as a perfectly good person. And then we go on from that position of righteousness to pursue obedience. It's on the account of the gift of righteousness that we desire to be obedient, not to our own idea of what is good, but to God's standard for what is good. It is on account of that righteousness that we are free to obey for the glory of God rather than for our personal benefits. It's on account of that righteousness that we follow hard after Christ. And what glorious news it is that because of our position of goodness in Christ, we are free from the crushing realities of condemnation and shame, even as we continue to fail to be good. The question left to answer is, how do we gain this gift of goodness? It's a good question, but I have to tell you, to anybody who really wants to be a good person, it sounds like utter foolishness. If you want to gain the gift of righteousness offered by Jesus, you have to see the futility of trying to be good on your own. And you have to stop trying to be good on your own. Jesus doesn't need your good deeds to make you good, and he will not accept them. So if you want to be good, what you have to do is admit that you can't be. That's repentance. You need to confess that you deserve God's wrath. And then you simply believe. You believe in Christ. You trust in the righteousness of Jesus, and it will be yours. And here's some even better news. Because of what Jesus did, you get his righteousness and you get God's acceptance. No more wrath, no more condemnation, no more shame, just love, the love of God. Lastly, quickly, remember that both Lord and the preacher believed that if they could be good, they would be happy. Yes, the world says, be good to be happy. But the wisdom of God says, be happy because Christ is good. Our sense of joy and contentment in life doesn't have to be tied to how well we perform on a given day. If it is tied to Christ, and you know that in him you have righteousness and acceptance and the love of God, you can, even on your worst day, rejoice in the Lord always. Lauren's therapist tried to give her good advice. She didn't need good advice. She needed good news. She needed to be told that though she can't be good, Jesus was. And if she would simply come to him by faith, she would be given something she could never achieve on her own, perfect righteousness in the sight of God. Some of you are like Lauren. You wish you could be better. You wish you were a better mom, wife, husband, father, employee, volunteer. You wish you were a better Christian. You think that you'll find some contentment if you can just try a little harder. Be careful of what wisdom you look to. The world can't offer you anything. Look to the person of Jesus and his righteousness, and there you'll find everything. Let's pray.